welcome everyone to the Indie Week, the independent Central North Carolina's news independent journal, read by John Federson for this week's podcast, presented by the North Carolina Reading Service for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners. Right, and it's a very full issue this week, and I'm going to get started with our first article. All right, first, State Trooper Garrett Macario and his supervisor, Sergeant Matthew Morrison, no longer work for the North Carolina State Highway Patrol, SHP, said a spokesperson for that agency, confirmed to the Indy on Tuesday. Recordings released last month in response to a successful petition from a coalition of media outlets, including Indy, showed Macario chasing 31-year-old Tyrone Mason before Mason's vehicle fatally wrecked along Capitol Boulevard last October. Macario then called Morrison at the scene of the crash, and the two decided Macario would tell responding Raleigh police officers that he was not chasing Mason's vehicle and had only happened upon the crash. On June 16th, Macario and Morrison were dismissed. In the statement, attorneys for the Mason family called the firings a clear step in the right direction. They came after Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman declined to criminally charge Macario and Morrison for their actions, but the DA's office has dismissed more than 200 cases involving the two after the State Bureau of Investigation, SBI, prompted Freeman to review recordings from the crash, which was under investigation. Last month, Mason's mother, Henrietta Mason, filed a federal lawsuit against Macario seeking a jury trial and damages in an amount to be determined by the court. 2 weeks ago, Mason and her attorneys, including nationally known civil rights attorneys Bakari Sellers and Ben Crump, and Raleigh lawyer Sean Cecil, filed a notice of claim against Raleigh Police Department for significant mental and emotional damages. And the filing alleges that in a May 21st meeting with Freeman, Freeman told Henrietta Mason that roughly 30 minutes after arriving on the scene of the crash, Raleigh police, quote, learned the truth regarding Macario's role in Mr. Mason's death. Despite knowing the facts of what happened, the filing continues, Raleigh police investigator and RPD, quote, misled Henrietta Mason for months regarding the circumstances of the death, effectively gaslighting her in regard to the truth. Continuing now, from Raleigh, Wake County landlords are owed almost $2 million in unpaid rent from Wake Housing Authority and others. Nancy Powell and her daughter rent a house in Wendell with help from a housing assistance voucher. Each month, Powell pays her share of the rent directly to her landlord, and the Wake County Housing Authority, WCHA, is supposed to pay the other part. The agency began making late payments last November, according to emails between Powell and her landlord that the Indy has seen. The delays grew longer each month. The CHA's share of December's rent didn't arrive until January 9th, and then January's rent didn't come until February 21st. By April 7th, when the landlord still hadn't received March or April from CHA, he informed Powell, who was up to date on her own payments, that he might have to terminate her lease. The landlord wrote to Powell, I've been attempting to communicate with Wake Housing for some time now regarding issues with their payments for you, and they have been continually dodging me and ignoring me. You're a good tenant, and we don't want you to have to move out, but if we can't get any resolution on this, we're going to have to terminate the lease and ask you to vacate the property by the end of the month. Powell says she called and visited CHA repeatedly, but the Wake County Housing Authority, they either ignored her or claimed not to know the answers to her questions. She says one former staff member at the agency even hung up on her landlord mid-conversation. In May, Powell says her landlord asked her to leave the apartment by the end of June. saying he doesn't trust WCHA anymore because of how inappropriately they handled the situation. It's been hard for my daughter. She was crying like, I'm tired of moving every year. And it's very stressful and expensive. If you're on a housing voucher, you can't exactly afford to move. Powell and her landlords and her landlord are not the only ones who have had trouble getting rental payments and answers from WCHA, the federally funded agency in charge of managing Wake County's public housing and distributing vouchers. In his May report to the WCHA board, interim director Michael Best wrote, WCHA owes about $1.9 million in unpaid rent to landlords around the county. Meeting minutes from the board meeting in May detail Best's report and list a series of guests who took turns raising concerns about the agency's operation. The first speaker, a representative from a regional property management firm, Fitch Eric Corporation, complained that WCHA owed them rent money. The second speaker, a private landlord, was experiencing the same problem. The third, Wake County Commissioner Sophia Jackson, quote, expressed her concern regarding the crisis at the Housing Authority, according to Minutes, and asked how she and the county could help course correct. Indy has asked Best about the overdue payments and crisis. He explained that after he was hired in April, he learned that the Housing Authority had recently experienced a large amount of staff turnover, which led to emails from landlords and tenants going unanswered and complaints going unresolved. Best said he learned the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, which oversees the voucher program for low-income renters, had assisted WCHA's operation, determined the agency was troubled in HUD parlance, and prescribed a recovery plan. And Best says it's a very complex situation. Bottom line, we have to take each individual case and try to work through it in order to get some resolution. According to Best, WCHA inherited most of its current problems. In addition to managing some 300 units of public housing and distributing about 540 housing vouchers each year, the agency is responsible for low-income renters who move to Wake County from other jurisdictions and bring their housing assistance vouchers with them, or live in Wake County but have a voucher from a statewide housing authority. This happens to be the case for Powell. Her voucher comes from the North Carolina Commission on Indian Affairs. The initial housing authority is supposed to pay WCHA for those recipients' housing assistance, which the CHA is supposed to pass along to their new landlords, but Best said the WCHA is owed $1.9 million by 114 different public housing authorities around the country. How did WCHA allow that balance to climb so high? According to Best, before he arrived, the agency failed to submit updated HUD paperwork for 260 voucher households who moved to Wake County from other jurisdictions. Without that paperwork, the initial housing authorities didn't know whether or how much money to send to WCHA. Best says the WCHA has cleared the paperwork backlog for all but 54 of those 260 households and is working to finish the rest. He adds that even without updated paperwork, HUD instructs initial housing authorities to continue paying the tenants' rent. Best and his staff are currently in the process of contacting each of the 114 public housing authorities individually to ask them to pay. He describes a laborious process of back-and-forth messages, conference calls, and exchanges of paperwork to settle each balance. He adds that a handful of housing authorities, including Durham's and New York City's, owe the majority of the $1.9 million. It's going to take a little time, he says, but bottom line, we're on top of it. In a response to a request for comment, Durham Housing Authority declined to say how much they owe WCHA, but indicated that payments are owed both ways. A spokesperson wrote in an email, "We have been in contact with Wake County Housing Authority as recent as this last week regarding the outstanding payments as well as the payments they owe us." Even if the out-of-town housing authorities are to blame for some of the unpaid rent, it's not entirely clear why it has taken WCHA so long to start trying to collect the money. One reason seems to be the high turnover at the agency. Best says most of his staff have only been at WCHA a few months longer than he has, and there was, quote, a big turnover after the pandemic. In response to Indy's inquiry about reasons for the turnover, he says, "I don't even know, because nobody's really here to even ask that question." WCHA has hired 4 new staff members since Best arrived, he says. They now only have one crucial vacancy to fill and are actively interviewing candidates for that role. The WCHA website lists 14 current employees, and Best says, "We have adequate staffing to aggressively address the issues at hand." As for the total number of unpaid cases the WCHA is handling right now, he couldn't say for certain. Best says, "I'm working 15 or 20 directly. These are ones the landlords have sent over emails, and we're researching to find out the status of their payments, but I realize there's more." He also declined to provide a timeline for when all the past due rent will be paid because of interagency coordination involved. HUD and Wake County have both taken notice of the WCHA's challenges. HUD's recovery plan includes a series of internal evaluations and reforms, Best says. Although WCHA is an independent agency, the Wake County Board of Commissioners appoints its board. A Wake County spokesperson said to Indy, "We are aware of the concerns that renters and landlords have voiced regarding timely payment, and we're willing to support the housing authority as they work to address these challenges." Next article, released on the 24th of June, "I like big challenges," says the new CEO of Go Triangle. On Brian Smith's first day as CEO of Go Triangle, he commuted to work via the 800 bus. Carlos, his driver, dropped him off at the agency headquarters in a sleepy office park near RTP. The otherwise nondescript building has a triangular protrusion at the front, with windowed walls that converge at an aggressively acute angle above the parking lot. Behind them, up on the second floor, is Smith's office. "On the day of our meeting," writes Chloe Bowl, correspondent, "only 2 weeks into his tenure, the room is almost empty, save for some standard issue furniture, papers scattered across his desk, and a plaque engraved 'People First' on display atop his still bare bookcase. The large common room outside Smith's door is also noticeably unfurnished and blank, as if Go Triangle itself is new to the building. It isn't. As he leads me through the space, Smith mentions he'd like to liven it up. The pale gray walls are crying out for his attention, as perhaps the agency itself. 'I like big challenges,' Smith says, watching from a distance. It was clear to me the board and others were very actively working to sort of reposition Go Triangle, given the history. Go Triangle's bus routes are the main arteries of the region's public transit network, connecting Go Raleigh, Go Durham, Go Cary, and Chapel Hill Transit to one another. The agency is also responsible for transit-related construction projects like Raleigh's RUS bus facility, which officially opens this week, by the way, and the planned Triangle Mobility Hub in Research Triangle Park, and for managing the Triangle Tax District. That's a special tax authority for regional public transportation projects. That jumble of responsibilities produced some internal discord at Grow Triangle in the past several years, as its new strategic plan describes. after the agency repeatedly failed to deliver on promises of a regional light rail project. Go Triangle admitted it had lost trust from its regional partners and a buy-in from the public. More recently, its former CEO, Charles Latuca, resigned in September, and ridership and on-time arrivals dropped at the start of 2025. Now, the agency is working to redefine itself and boost ridership as the cities it serves continue to grow. Enter Smith, the former deputy CEO of Hampton Roads Transit, which operates 60 bus routes and a light rail line across 8 cities and towns in eastern Virginia. He has a PhD in organizational leadership and 16 years of experience in the field of public transportation. His vision for the agency's future, at least its immediate future, is to improve upon the services it already provides rather than undertake some grand new project. He wants to increase frequency along key routes, strengthen existing partnerships, and cultivate relationships with current, lapsed, and new riders. Now, in this rest of this article is in interview format. Indy asked him what riders and residents can expect from Go Triangle under his leadership. Question: what changes are coming to Go Triangle in the near term? The Rus Bus project is really a game changer for Go Triangle and for our ability to serve customers who are trying to get to different places throughout the region, particularly from Raleigh Union Station. That's the RUS. And then we're implementing a 15-minute service frequency on Route 400. That's connecting really important locations between Durham and Chapel Hill, the healthcare facilities, and so forth. Our plan is to continue to do more of that in the spring. The Route 100 and the Route 700 are the next that we're planning to implement this 15-minute service frequency on. These are services that people are relying on every day already. But as we continue to make them easier to use and more convenient, hopefully, we'll see more people getting on board. Oh, one other really important project that's a little more behind the scenes is improving our main bus operations and maintenance facility. That's the location where we service all of our buses and dispatch all our buses from. It's already reached its useful life in many respects and is sort of at capacity. So we're going to be doing some important upgrades to that facility that's going to enable us to support these service improvements in the years ahead. The other thing, strengthening our partnerships across the region. I see a future where Go Triangle is able to expand the number of partnerships that we have to continue to increase ridership and just really bring more value to the region. Since getting here, you've probably heard that people in the Triangle are really hungry for light rail, commuter rail, bus rapid transit, some kind of large-scale public transport project connecting the region. What role would Go Triangle play in that type of endeavor, if it ever comes to be? What the future holds is still to be determined, based upon our ongoing dialogue with our partners about what kind of transit options are going to be the best fit long-term and how we work together to achieve that. I haven't been here long enough to know. I'm getting to know more people, and I'm hearing about the different rail projects. Communities around the country are looking at the very same questions the Triangle area is looking at, and more of them have moved away from big rail projects and toward investing in bus service, whether that's BRT or high-frequency bus service. Delivering quality bus service can move a lot of people efficiently at a significantly lower cost than big rail projects. And you still see communities around the country investing in rail. I mean, look at our neighbors in Charlotte as an example. But it's just that they are also comparatively a lot more expensive, and more communities have chosen to do bus projects over rail, in part because of the cost. back to regular bus service? Do you have a goal of where you want ridership to be? And do you have a sense of how close you are to reaching it? That's a great question, and I really want to get more dialed in on our operating profile and some of those opportunities to grow. I don't have enough awareness yet of what exactly those things would look like, but I do know we've got to provide reliable service at the end of the day. That's in our mission statement, connecting people and the region with high-quality transit. I want our customers to be able to know they can count on Go Triangle to get them where they need to go. We're providing the critical regional connectivity that I think is so important to people being able to enjoy all the wonderful things the region has to offer. I guess I'll wax philosophical about this for a moment. When we think about a region, city planners might think about zoning ordinances and land use. And businesses think about customers or employees. There's lots of different ways to answer the question of what is the region. But at the end of the day, it all boils down to people. People are trying to get to work, medical appointments, shopping. So how do we connect people around the region? Effectively, that's what we're focused on doing. I think Go Triangle fills a very important role in doing that. All right, my folder is quite thick with all sorts of articles, and let's get over to Durham for another interview type of article about Durham's budget. We've covered that in some detail in the past weeks, but here's Justin Laidlaw's column. He's found something else. Ask Indy, what are some under-the-radar items in that Durham budget? On June 16th, the City Council approved $722 million for next year's budget. Major highlights? Investments in public safety, transportation, employee pay, and infrastructure projects. But in a growing metro like Durham, for example, that budget a decade ago was just $388 million. Those hundreds of millions are split up nearly 100 million ways, and line items can go from grand to microscopic. Today's Ask Indy submission inquires, a lot of news organizations are posting about similar large items on the budget, but I'd love to know if there are any smaller additions you think citizens may be interested in as well. And Justin Laidlaw provides us about four or five of those just to start with. City council salaries. I'm sure this is of interest to everyone, especially the Reddit watchdogs. City council members each make $45,500 plus an extra $55,000 for the mayor. That totals $327,000. Since 2022, their salaries have been tied to the Durham minimum livable wage. The City Council just received a raise thanks to an increase from $19.50 to almost $22 per hour. City Council members are not precluded from having other jobs, but voters may be put off by potential conflicts of interest, and there's only so many hours in a day. Sister cities of Durham. Next time you visit Durham Central Park, look out for the totem pole with arrows scribed with the city name and distance. Each represents one of 10 sister cities. The program aims to maintain friendly intercultural relationships with cities across the world and received $18,500 this year, or about 0.00256% of the total budget. When I was a student at Brogdon Middle School, some of my classmates hosted exchange students from our sister city, Toyama, Japan. The program's budget allocation is barely a raindrop in the ocean, but Durham's Shimaitoshi program signals to communicate across the world that Durham is a welcoming place. Trees. Other communities may have given up on DEI, but Durham is committed to planting 1,300 trees in communities most affected by climate and economic hardship using an unspecified amount of Inflation Reduction Act funding. The city's a long way from replacing all the trees that have been cut down in service of our housing need, but 1,300 is a start. Reckless Roxborough. The potential two-way conversion of Roxborough and Mangum Street is an ongoing saga with many twists and turns, but the city remains committed to the idea of reimagining the streets. The budget includes $1.2 million, or 17.17%, to continue moving the conversation down the road. Stay tuned for an update on this project from me soon. And he ends, you could spend days diving into the budget and still not completely understand what it takes to keep the city financially solvent. But if you're a government wonk and want to learn more about how it all fits together, sign up for the Durham Neighborhood College. That's a link. Where the link on this printed article is not available for me, the Durham Neighborhood College, or join a local board or a commission. I'll just move over to some culture. The Indy has selected what to do in the Triangle this week, and almost all of the articles pertain to Durham. And I'll just get into that. Sarah Edwards, Eva Flo, and Chase DePauw have contributed to this. To do. There is a film, Miss Major film, Pride Dance Party. Major documents the life of Miss Major Griffin Gracie, a formerly incarcerated transgender woman and Stonewall Rebellion veteran. Now, this film, Friday the day you'll first hear this, at the Pinhook in Durham. June 27th at 7:30 p.m. is this Pride Dance Party. The documentary examines Griffin Gracie's experience in men's prisons as well as community activism and sex work. This screening of Major at the Pinhook is a fundraiser for Comfrey Films, a Durham-based Afrofuturistic filmmakers organization dedicated to bringing more black and transgender stories to the screen. After watching Griffin Gracie tell her story on screens, film buffs are invited to dance at a Pride after party. The showing is hosted by Sanctuary Embodied, an organization offering somatic workshops, leadership training, and other programming. The film begins at 8 p.m., it's Friday, June 27th at the Pinhook, and dancing at 10 p.m. Tickets are between $5 and $20 in donation form. All right, Saturday, also at the Pinhook, Cobola/Rodent. 8 p.m. Saturday at the Pinhook. Moog Fest may be gone, but its spirit lives on in Boom Club. That's an electronic music incubator in Durham. If this sounds mysterious, you can find out more at the club's pop-up synthesizer clubhouse at the Rail Car on the American Tobacco campus, a residency which takes place every weekend through July 27th, a month to go on that, every weekend. Drop by the space, an actual rail car, which has been transformed into a hands-on electronics hub with, quote, extensive library of vintage modern synthesizers, drum machines, samplers, modular and Eurorack gear, performance tools, and cutting-edge music tech. That's from the Boom Club website. Or attend a performance put on by the club at the Pinhook, featuring Eric Rodent Cheslak, a modular synth artist from Asheville, and Cobola, that's Collins Oboe, a Nigerian-born, Los Angeles-based producer and composer. I might just add that I visited the Moog Museum in Asheville, which has something similar, appears to me, a collection of at least sound samples from maybe 30 or 40 different synthesizers that have made their self known in classical music and electronic and pop music over decades. And it's quite a place, very small, but if this is anything like that, it's worth a trip. All right, that's to hear. To do, Saturday in Dura, Motorco Music Hall at 9 p.m., Shrek Rave. It's a Shrek-themed rave, and if you don't get it, I can't explain it to you. Durham is just one of 40 cities that will play host to the Verdant Bacchanalia this summer. It's dumb. Just come have fun. Who cares? Says the website. Get green. Get wild. Why the hell not? Okay. And we see through June the 29th, that's this weekend, The Color Purple is being performed live at Raleigh Little Theater. That's Alice Walker's Pulitzer Prize-winning classic. Came to life in musical form this month with a Raleigh Little Theater production directed by Tia James. Beginning in turn of the century, Georgia, The Color Purple follows Celie, black, poor, and abused by man time and time again through a series of letters that trace her evolution across 40 years as she gains confidence and is able to heal and challenge the forces of her oppression. In this production at the Raleigh Little Theater, which features jazz, ragtime, gospel, African music, and blues, Ajaria Vaughn takes the lead as Celie, with Tydiam Coleman as Shug Ivory and DeAndre Sanders as Mister. This is the show's last run. If you've been considering going to see it, don't wait any longer. Tickets at the Raleigh Little Theater start at $29, and it ends on June the 29th. And finally, back to Durham for the July 1st, Tuesday night, 8:30 p.m., stargazing on the rooftop of the Durham Hotel. When my friends from bigger cities visit the Triangle, they almost always comment on how good the views of the night sky are here. Sure, it's no dark sky preserve, but we're pretty lucky to be able to make out some of the brightest objects up there. Take advantage of that. And the drop in temperature after the sun sets on the roof of the Durham Hotel. Buy a fancy cocktail and join astronomers from UNC's Moorhead Planetarium, and apparently a DJ, in observing and learning about the crescent moon and Mars. And that's just a few. Of course, this is a more or less a curated selection from the editors and writers at the Indy about what to do this week. Now, folks, reading about The Color Purple has reminded me of my backlog of articles in the Indy Week. And here's one that was written just a week ago on the 21st about Juneteenth at Stagville. Mary Walker faced an impossible choice in the 1850s, her children or her freedom. Walker, born into slavery in Durham, had a rare opportunity when the Cameron family, her enslavers, took her on a visit to Philadelphia. But if she tried to live as a free woman in Philadelphia, she would likely never again see her mother and three kids, who she left behind on the plantation now known as Stagville in northern Durham County. Walker fled. She spent the following years of her life hoping, praying, and working to figure out how she could get her family free, said Vera Chachelski, site manager of historic Stagville. And she's talking to a tour group of about 40 people on a sunny Juneteenth. Walker worked as a seamstress and housekeeper and hoped to buy her children's freedom or to pay for someone to help them escape. Finally, in the aftermath of the Civil War, she was reunited with two of her children after 17 years apart. Walker's story, like the story of Juneteenth itself, is one of struggle and celebration held hand in hand. It's also one reflected in the experiences of many enslaved people in this state's history. Chichelsky notes that at the time of emancipation, about one in three people in North Carolina were enslaved. And she says, we often hear the story of emancipation as a national story in the scope of this broad conflict of the American Civil War, but we really wanted to look at these intimate local stories of how were real families here in what is now Durham County experiencing the transition to freedom? What were their dreams and worries in those first few months of freedom? Stagville, which was once part of a vast Cameron family plantation that spanned 30,000 acres and was home to about 1,000 enslaved people at its peak, is now a state-owned historical site. On Juneteenth, tours that normally cost a dollar or two are free, and hundreds of locals make the pilgrimage to walk the land where generations of enslaved people lived and labored. Chichelsky says the site draws two or three times as many visitors on Juneteenth as it does on an ordinary weekend day. Stagville isn't a dusty museum, though. Chichelsky's tour is built on the fact that the descendants of the people who were enslaved there are very much alive and involved in how Stagville presents its history today. And after the day's tours are gone, some of those descendants will gather on the land to mark another Juneteenth. She takes a tour through a row of sparse two-story wooden houses that held 20 to 30 enslaved people each, packed into claustrophobic rooms when the plantation was active from 1771 to 1865. In between two of the houses, Khadija McNair's two daughters play in the shade of a 200-year-old walnut tree. The tree, thought to be the oldest at Stagville, was planted around 1818 when Mary Walker was born into slavery on the plantation. As she juggles two pink water bottles and manages her young daughters, please don't swing that stick around, she warns one of the thigh-high youngsters. McNair tells me that she brought her daughters to Stagville on Juneteenth because she was born and raised in Durham, but didn't learn about the plantation's history until she was an adult, and says, being from Durham, being black, I want them to know that this history is a history of us and our people, and they were strong so we can be strong. McNair previously worked at historic Stagville and now works at Freedom Park in Raleigh, which will had its own Juneteenth celebration a couple weeks ago. Against the trunk of the walnut tree, McNair and her daughters left three pink and white roses. McNair said, I want my kids to know this is a day to reflect and honor the struggles, the violence, but also the resilience of our ancestors. And it's also a holiday for celebration. Next, from Durham Refugee Day, Durham Central Park. And that was just a week ago. Danine Khan writes this column. Reggae music and children's laughter filled the air on Saturday as hundreds of community members gathered to learn, shop, and celebrate Durham's vibrant refugee presence. Attendees came to Durham Central Park for the 6th annual Durham Refugee Day. Organized by the City of Durham, local chapters of Refugee Aid Organizations World Service, and Church World Relief, CWS, and various Triangle-based partners. Kaku Nayo, the Durham City County Immigrant and Refugee Affairs Coordinator, said, we are here celebrating refugees and their contribution in Durham, and as local government, we are here to support. Durham Refugee Day began in 2017 after the first Trump administration enacted a series of travel bans primarily targeting Muslim-majority nations. Adam Clark, executive director of World Relief Durham, said World Relief, CWS, and then Mayor of Durham Steve Shule wanted to show their opposition to the bans. Parenthetically, I'll tell you, Steve Shule used to run the Independent. In 2023, Durham County was home to over 45,000 foreign-born residents, about 15% of the entire population. Clark said, I know that some folks are probably staying home today because of the changed climate. We want to continue this event to show our solidarity and make sure we don't back down from our love for, appreciation for, and strong stance with refugees and immigrants. Earlier this year, President Trump indefinitely froze a refugee resettlement, resulting in only approximately 27,000 refugees having been admitted in the year 2025. The freeze brought furloughs and challenges to organizations like World Relief and CWS. Although individuals admitted as refugees have legal status in the United States, fear of deportation and detainment has hit documented and undocumented immigrants. North Carolina legislature recently passed bills requiring law enforcement to cooperate with ICE, and Trump remains committed to detaining and deporting undocumented immigrants, especially those in Democratic-run cities. Yet among the political climate, or perhaps in spite of it, Durham Refugee Day maintained an era of celebration. Kids sat for face paint as parents enjoyed live music from reggae band Dub Addis. Families clapped in a call and response led by Swa African Dance Group. And when members of the Takiri Folkcore Latino Dance Group ran into the audience, some attendees joined them in a circle, smiling as they spun to the music. Individuals and organizations set up tables across the park's Farmers Market Pavilion. Mona Singh, a Cary resident running for Wake County Commissioner, organized her table with friends. Together, they brought over 1,000 pieces of South Asian jewelry and clothing to give away. Singh, who is originally from India, said she used to teach English to refugees through CWS and would donate clothes to them. But since February, her students have stopped coming, first because of the fear of ICE and then because the influx of new refugees halted. Even as her booth was surrounded by shoppers, Singh said she noticed fewer refugees in the crowd, saying, A lot of people coming here used to be in my English class, so I know them. I was expecting to see a lot more, and I know they need this. They love this. Fatima Momad, who immigrated from Pakistan in 2016, said events like World Refugee Day bring happiness and resources to people who need it. Momad has been fighting to bring her mother and siblings to the United States since 2020. Her family hails from Afghanistan. Afghans in Pakistan are subject to harassment, discrimination, and mass deportation. She said, speaking of refugees across the country, everybody's come here for a better future and study and safety because our countries are not safe. About halfway through this event, Nayo welcomed Durham City Council member Javier Caballero, Didriana Freeman and Chelsea Cook, along with County Commissioner Michelle Burton and Stephen Valentine, to the stage. Caballero read Durham County's proclamation of Durham Refugee Day 2025 before sharing a few words with the crowd. And she said, Your elected officials now, your elected officials previously, and your elected officials to come will always stand with immigrants and refugees because that's how we do it in Durham. Always know we will have your backs. Always know that we will rise to every single challenge that affects our immigrant and refugee communities. All right. More from a bit of a backlog now from June the 5th. Justin Laidlaw from Durham. And talk an article about Psychic Hotline. That's a new record label founded by Nick Sanborn and Amelia Meath of Sylvan Esso. With longtime manager Martin Anderson, has planted its flag in downtown Durham with a retail pop-up called Psychic Hotline Mailroom. The mailroom is located at 316 Holland Street. It sits at the end of a cobblestone alleyway next to the Durham Hotel. Psychic Hotline keeps an office on the second floor as the label headquarters and an actual mailroom on the first floor for shipping out online orders. But since 2022, the label has periodically opened up a small room at the front of the building for in-person shopping. That's a way to connect with fans and showcase the label. The mailroom pop-up first made its debut 3 years ago for The Greatest Show on Dirt, a three-day music series at Durham Athletic Park, hosted and headlined by Sylvan Esso. Will Hackney, head of production at Psychic, is one of three employees who take shifts running the pop-up alongside Anderson and the direct sales coordinator, Devon Tuttle. Most of the folks at Psychic have a history of working in record stores. Hackney says, "We like that social interaction, sharing music directly and getting to chat about things that we like." Hackney and Anderson both grew up in Chapel Hill, where Anderson used to hold down Sundays from noon to 8 p.m. at the CD Alley on Franklin Street. He says he still loves the ritual of overseeing the shop and connecting with fellow music lovers. Starting this spring, of course it's already summer now, the mailroom has regular limited hours on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. While you can't get a palm reading, you can expect to find a selection of new record releases and merchandise from Psychic Hotline's eclectic roster of artists and collaborators. Hackney says, "It's not outfitted like a real storefront, but we've been making little tweaks every few months to make it nice to be in there. When you're doing your Saturday errands, you can come by and check out some records or take part in some of the focused events we're doing with different artists and local business. In addition to selling records, you might catch DJs spinning records of their own during special events at the mailroom, which has played host to album releases, merch drops, and once, a pancake parties." Hackney says the space is a blank canvas that allows the label to share the mailroom with other creatives, both inside and outside the music industry, and provide opportunities to unite fan bases. Reina Tropical, a Mexican-American band that performed in 2024 at the Good Moon Festival, released their debut album, Malagria, on Psychic Hotline last year. To commemorate that release, the label worked with Reina Tropical and Little Waves Coffee, the owners of Coco Cinnamon, to create a custom coffee blend which was sold in limited quantities at a pop-up event there at the mailroom. And earlier this month, the label also partners with the team behind the No Visa Dance Party series to release a collaborative clothing collection at the mailroom, handing over the turntable reins to local DJs Mickey Slicks and Alec Lomami. No Visa and Psychic previously worked together on an after party during the label's 2022 mini festival at the Athletic Park, and Nick Sanborn, under his Made of Oak moniker, has performed for No Visa events since that series started in 2019. The next collaboration on the horizon is a custom skate deck with the Manifest Skate Shop and musician-illustrator Nathaniel Russell. There's more of this article, but it more talks about the label itself, and I'll forego that for the reading of this one. It's long. Now, I'm choosing to talk about an event which had already took place, a musical event, but it introduces me and us to Dylan Louise Linehan. And it was written on the 5th of June, and it talks about a performance at Raleigh's Lincoln Theater on June 19th. However, here we go. During a three-year period of mysterious sickness that left her largely bedridden, Dylan Louise Linehan discovered something otherworldly. She says, I would be lying awake, eyes open, totally aware of being in the present moment, and I would hear these choirs and orchestrations just blaring in my ears as if I were in the orchestra pit. Now, more than a decade later, Linehan, now recovered and performing as Mad Gallica, prepares to bring her Fever Dream Symphonies to life at Raleigh's Lincoln Theater June 19th. The Wilmington native launched her solo career in late 2023 after spending 5 years as a touring keyboard and backing vocalist for Ghost, the Swedish heavy metal band that recently became the first hard rock act to top the Billboard's albums charts since AC/DC's Power Up in 2020. Known for grandiose performances where a frontman with skull makeup is backed by masked musicians, Ghost provided Linehan with what she calls a masterclass in performance and building a vision. Originally, the band required absolute anonymity from its members, known as Nameless Ghouls. Those rules have loosened somewhat over the past several years, allowing former members like Linehan to discuss their involvement. While on tour with Ghost, she was cultivating a dynamic vision of her own. Videos on her Mad Gallica YouTube channel, Mad Gallica, spelled G-A-L-L-I-C-A, YouTube channel, include everything from a one-woman band cover of Jolene, where she cycles through multiple costumes and instruments, at one moment singing demonic harmonies from a theater box before cutting to headbanging on stage with a guitar, to a recorded live stream called Live from the Infinite Void, where she performs an eclectic set ranging from Etta James to Neil Young to the Appalachian murder ballad Tom Dooley. Okay, eclectic. Throughout her years with Ghost, she tested her solo material, which she generally categorizes as rock popera, like rock opera, at small venues and found a different kind of fulfillment in those personal performances. And she says it's such an exciting experience when you're performing at that level in front of thousands of people. But it's also a thrilling experience to be performing your own music in front of 100 people that are 5 feet away from you. She ultimately decided to transition from being a nameless ghoul to Mad Gallica. That's a name inspired by the Gallica Rose Nebula. That's a fantasy realm she had conceived during her illness. That began when she was in college, what initially seemed like a particularly rough bout with mono. As it stretched on, doctors found evidence of multiple viruses but couldn't identify the underlying cause, leaving Linehan in a prolonged state of being in between worlds, she says. Lying in bed during those months, she began composing what would eventually become a concept album about journeying through the vortex of our mind. When you're still for a long time, your mind wanders, she said. I created this world I would slip away to. It was really important for me to try to bring this music to life in the way that I heard it, in that fever dream state. The ambitious Enter the Vortex album follows a narrative of characters incarnating from the cosmic realm into the human experience. With dozens of songs written, but limited resources, Linehan turned to fans for support. She has so far used crowd-sourced funds to record 5 songs for her debut extended play, Enter the Vortex, Act One, recording them with a symphony in Prague. The EP's opening track is something of an overture, beginning with an angelic choral chant, Come with us, conquer your death, before breaking into a thunderous rock passage where Linehan belts with ferocity about begging for feeling. As the EP progresses, the narrative intensifies with questions of agency. Are you the one who wields the dagger, or the one who lets the dagger wield your hand? By the fifth track, the celestial protagonist is growing achingly human, wondering, if life is so precious, how can I know this without dying? Linehan envisions this Enter the Vortex project expanding into an animated film someday. She's already adapted it into an hour-long guided meditation video. The Lincoln Theater show blended the ethereal sounds of Enter the Vortex Act 1 with a debut of Act 2 material, which Linehan forecasts as having a denser, more earthly sonic landscape. For the show, she assembled a four-piece band where each member adopts their own Vortex identity. Guitarist Joe Sprunt becomes Blue Magnolia. Bassist Eric LeRae is Thorn. Drummer Phil Mulligan becomes Lotus. And the music director and vocalist Matt Goines is Calyx. Their costumes feature bioluminescent elements. Linehan says that show will be, quote, a full-on experience where the audience participates. She envisions something like a Rocky Horror Picture Show screening with interactive elements and a call for audience members to embrace their own personas. She says, I really want the audience to, before they come to the show, think about who they are in their most grand, superhero, fantastical form. Come to the show as that. What makes you feel empowered, makes you feel excited, makes you feel intergalactic and interdimensional. I hope to cultivate that kind of culture. We get to be weird and wild and explore our madness together. Now that ends that article. Just a reminder, though, that she has a website on YouTube. I'm looking it up right now. A YouTube called Mad Gallica, and you can probably find a lot of detail about Linehan's ideas and concepts and maybe some of her work. Well, here comes our theme song, and John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service has to bid you farewell. Indie Week is available as a podcast, first broadcast Fridays. And after that, it's in our enormous library of other podcasts. So The Independent is available also online for free, or you could, of course, can subscribe, indieweek.com. And the North Carolina Reading Service was pleased to bring our audience this journal each week. John Federson now bids you so long. Thanks for listening.